The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated September 13/September 20, 2021. As usual, it has a red border on the front cover. The background within that border today is black, with the large Time superimposed in silver gray, all caps, large lettering upon that black. Halfway, practically centered within this cover page, is a dog tag, enlarged somewhat. I would say it's approximately 1.5 by 3 inches in this photo. It hangs from a chain, a durable chain. There are thumbprints on the dog tag, but there's also a photo of a young man looking somber in uniform. And beneath that is the heading, "This War Will Not End for Me." Sylvia Gutierrez's son was among the last of the 2,461 U.S. troops killed in Afghanistan after 20 years of combat. A family's grief endures. We will visit that article. And that photograph was by Kathleen Flynn for Time. Beginning now with some of the copy from within Time Magazine. For the record, I have 3 alternatives for my future: being arrested, killed, or victory. That was spoken by Hair, J-A-I-R, Bolsonaro, Brazilian president, speaking August 28 about next year's election. They are the 21st century digital version of snake oil salesmen. Spoken by Dr. Erwin Redlener, that's R-E-D-L-E-N-E-R, founding director of the National Center for Disaster Preparedness, on the political group America's Frontline Doctors, which a Time investigation found was selling access to prescriptions for the antiparasitic drug ivermectin to treat COVID-19, despite medical authorities' warnings. Good news of the week, astronaut Megan MacArthur celebrated her 50th birthday in style after a supply ship docked August 30 at the International Space Station, bringing cookies and other gifts. Deeply troubling. The International Atomic Energy Agency, reacting in a new report to North Korea's apparent restart of its main nuclear reactor at Yongbyon, in July. It is no secret that the governor and I were not close. Kathy Hochul, spelled H-O-C-H-U-L, said this, the New York governor, speaking to a local reporter August 23 about her predecessor, Andrew Cuomo, who resigned after an investigation found he had sexually harassed women. Britney Spears will not be bullied or extorted by her father. Matthew Rosengart, Spears' lawyer, said in a statement on August 30, court filings demanding Spears' father resign without payment as conservator of his daughter's estate. $200, the monthly insurance surcharge Delta employees will be asked to pay if they are not vaccinated against COVID-19, the airline announced August 25. And three, the number of hours a week during which minors in China will be allowed to play online games, started September 1. The new policy will be one of the strictest facing the gaming industry. From the milestones page, agreed, payback for Gavin Grimm, G-R-I-M-M, a crucial case. There's a photo here of Grimm, a young man dressed in a dark gray hoodie with some blue lettering on it, and the only thing I can read from the lettering is L-U. Short, dark hair, glasses, smiling. I said it's a young man. I should have said it's a young person. It's a crucial case in 2015 when he sued Virginia's Gloucester County School Board over its refusal to allow him to use the bathroom consistent with his gender identity. Gavin Grimm was just 16. 6 years later, his case is coming to an end, with the school board promising to pay $1.3 million in legal fees to his representation, the American Civil Liberties Union, per August 26 court filings. The suit became a center of national attention when a slew of transgender bathroom bans were introduced by Republican-controlled state legislatures. The case worked its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which declined June 28 to hear it, affirming a lower court's decision that the policy violated both Title IX and the Constitution. But even as Grimm has cause to celebrate, trans youth in the U.S. still face a range of obstacles, with lawmakers more recently targeting their rights to play sports or receive medical care. I hope that this outcome sends a strong message to other school systems, Grimm said August 26, that discrimination is an expensive, losing battle. And that article was written by Madeline Carlisle. Seven more short snippets here under the milestones column. Recommended parole for Sirhan Sirhan, 77, who was convicted in 1969 of assassinating Senator Robert F. Kennedy, August 27. Appeared three men held at the U.S. military prison in Guantanamo Bay in court August 31 to face charges for deadly attacks in Southeast Asia in the early 2000s. The case got underway 18 years after they were first captured. Passed wide-ranging voting restrictions by the Texas legislature August 31, ending months of partisan battling during which Democrats fled the state in an attempt to delay the vote. Set a speed limit of 30 kilometers hours under 20 miles per hour in Paris, August 30, in an attempt by the city to reduce pollution and improve road safety, projected that unless Congress acts, Social Security will have to cut benefits by 2034 instead of 2035, per an August 31 report citing, in part, the pandemic. Removed paintings and busts of seven past leaders by the Bank of England, the bank said August 27, after a review found they had connections to the slave trade. Grossed $22.3 million by Candyman, marking the first time a film directed by a black woman hit number one at the box office. One more article here on the milestones page. Written by Judy Berman, it's a bit lengthier. It features a photo. It's a portrait of a man sitting on a chair. Actually, the chair would appear to be backwards. We see only his shirt and his face. He's wearing a light-colored shirt, a dark-colored tie. His face looks grim, but not angry. He has short, balding, grayish hair and heavy, dark eyebrows, dark eyes penetrating that lens. This is a black and white photo, and it's Ed Asner in New York City in 1980, who holds a career record as the male actor to have won the most Emmys for his performances. Died Ed Asner, a crusader on screen and off. For Americans of a certain age, the archetypal journalist looks a lot like Ed Asner, gruff, temperamental, and jaded on the surface. His beloved character, Lou Grant, whom he played for 7 seasons on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and 5 on an eponymous spin-off that recast Lou as an L.A. newspaper editor, was at his core a principled defender of truth. Asner, who died August 29 at 91, took home 5 Emmys for the portrayal, which made him one of just 2 actors ever to win the award for playing the same character in both a comedy and a drama. Indelible, though it was, the role was just one highlight in a career that spanned 7 decades. Raised in an Orthodox Jewish household, Asner drove a taxi and worked on a GM assembly line before breaking into the theater in the mid-1950s. Film roles followed. He first shared the screen with Moore in the 1969 Elvis Presley flick Change of Habit. In later years, he became a sought-after voice actor, known for his heart-wrenching turn as a widower in Pixar's Up, and the king of the guest arc in memorable appearances on shows like Curb Your Enthusiasm and Dead to Me. Although he worked until the very end of his life, Asner also found time over the years to advocate for the causes he held dear. A lifelong progressive, he served 2 terms as president of the Screen Actors Guild, was a longtime member of the Democratic Socialists of America, and often claimed Lou Grant's cancellation was due to his outspoken opposition to the U.S.-backed junta in El Salvador, rather than poor ratings. Whether Lou would have agreed with those views is beside the point. As Asner's performance conveyed, TV's preeminent newsman would have defended to the death the actor's right to articulate them. The brief news. Good question. Why did OnlyFans, that's one word, OnlyFans, ban sexually explicit content, then U-turn? OnlyFans, the subscriber-based social media platform, sparked outrage last month when it announced it would ban sexually explicit content starting October 1. The platform, on which 2 million content creators charge subscribers for access to exclusive photos and videos, attributed the decision to pressure from banks and payment processors. OnlyFans' popularity took off during the pandemic as the site's user base rose from fewer than 20 million to 130 million, and transactions increased at least 7-fold, passing $2.3 billion. While the service was not originally designed for adult content, the user-friendly interface and subscriber model has made it an attractive destination for sex workers. So when OnlyFans announced the ban August 19, it threw the livelihoods of its core creator community into jeopardy. Many sex workers say they lost subscriptions overnight. In an interview with the Financial Times, OnlyFans British founder and chief executive Tim Stokely singled out BNY Mellon, Metro Bank, and J.P. Morgan Chase for blocking intermediary payments, preventing sex workers from receiving their earnings, and penalizing businesses that support sex workers. The short answer is banks, he said, explaining the decision. The pressure from those financial institutions follows similar behavior by payment service providers that have expressed concerns that illegal content, such as child sex abuse, is appearing alongside porn on mainstream adult content websites. In April of this year, for example, MasterCard announced tighter control on transactions involving adult content in an effort to clamp down on illegal material. Those new controls will become effective in October, and many observers saw OnlyFans actions, which would have come into effect at the beginning of October, as an attempt to get ahead of the expected policy change. And yet, only 6 days after the initial announcement, OnlyFans made a U-turn. The company tweeted August 25 it was suspending its ban, having secured assurances necessary to support our diverse creator community. According to the Financial Times, Stokely's comments had sparked open discussion between banks and the company. Still, while OnlyFans creators are now free to continue to sell sexually explicit content to users on the platform, some sex workers say they feel betrayed by the company and have vowed not to return to the platform. If anything, the company's actions have emphasized the influence of banks and payment service providers over social media and content creation platforms online. MasterCard will continue to process payments for sexually explicit content on OnlyFans, at least for now. Eloise Berry wrote that article. Here's a small item called Second Chances, Trials, and Errors. Four items here. Research by an eighth grade civics class inspired a Massachusetts lawmaker to introduce a bill to officially exonerate a woman who was convicted of witchcraft during the Salem witch trials. Here, three other historical figures whose cases were reconsidered. Sonia Mansour wrote this article. Joan of Arc. A little over two decades after the French icon was burned at the stake in 1431, accused of witchcraft and heresy, a retrial led to her being declared innocent of the charges that had led to her death. Oscar Wilde, the Irish playwright and novelist who was jailed for indecency in 1895, was among thousands of gay men pardoned by the UK government in 2017 of convictions for violating laws that banned same-sex relations. Susan B. Anthony, the suffragist, was arrested in 1872 for voting before women were allowed to do so. Former President Donald Trump pardoned her in 2020, though some historians argued that Anthony would not have wanted it. News ticker. Texas law strictly limits abortions. As of September 1, a Texas law banned abortion as early as 6 weeks, before many people are aware they are pregnant. The law faced challenges even as it took effect, but legal experts said its unusual structure. It enables private citizens to sue anyone who helps someone else get an abortion may make it more difficult to defeat in court. EU may reimpose U.S. travel limits. The European Union agreed August 30 to reimpose COVID-19 travel restrictions on U.S. travelers in response to rising rates of infection. EU member states ultimately set their own travel rules, but the decision to remove the U.S. from a list of safe countries was made unanimously. Mask bans trigger civil rights probe. The U.S. Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights opened an investigation August 30 into five GOP-led states that banned mask requirements in schools. The DOE argues the bans discriminate against students with disabilities and underlying health conditions. More news ticker here. Duterte plans to run for vice president. Rodrigo Duterte, president of the Philippines, said August 24 he would run for the country's vice presidency after his six-year term ends in 2022. His critics see the move as a bid to maintain power and to avoid prosecution for the thousands of extrajudicial killings that have marked his war on drugs. FBI reports increase in hate crimes. With more than 7,700 incidents documented in 2020, an increase of over 6% over the previous year, the FBI recorded a 12-year high for American hate crimes. The agency noted in a report released August 30 that more than 50% of race-related hate crimes involved bias against black people or African Americans. Haiti in need after deadly earthquake. 2 weeks after a 7.2 magnitude earthquake struck Haiti, August 14, leaving at least 2,207 dead, relief efforts had shifted from search and rescue to helping survivors in the areas hardest hit, disaster response workers told the AP. It was the deadliest natural disaster to strike the nation since the 2010 earthquake. Here's a photo. It's a bird's eye view from somewhere up in the ceiling, I guess. There's a wooden floor beneath, and the wooden floor is actually a border around a dark reddish-brown floor. And there's a basketball hoop. The camera lens is looking right through it to the floor. And surrounding the basketball hoop are 2, 4, 6, 7 wheelchairs. And some of the occupants of the wheelchairs have orange uniforms, and some have white and black uniforms. And here's the caption, "Up strong." Bo Kramer, representing the Netherlands, takes a shot against Spanish player Isabel Lopez Chavez during a women's wheelchair basketball game at the Tokyo 2020 Paralympic Games, August 29. Even though underlying health issues mean some Paralympic athletes face a higher risk from COVID-19, and with the pandemic already straining Japan's medical system, the games drew a record number of participants. Our last item here on the brief news page is with beneath the bulletin subtitle. It's written by Amy Gunia, G-U-N-I-A. China makes coal-powered plans, even as it promises a greener future. While leaders around the world talk about a post-pandemic green recovery, China has outlined plans to build 43 new coal-fired power plants, according to an August 13 report from Global Energy Monitor and the Center for Research on Energy and Clean Air. The new projects announced in the first half of 2021 would add 1.25% to China's annual carbon dioxide output, despite the country's pledge to be carbon neutral by 2060. Burning for growth, China, while not alone in its reliance on coal, built more than three times as much new coal power capacity as all other countries in the world combined in 2020. The plans for new coal power plants show that at least some Chinese officials are prioritizing economic growth over emissions reductions. There's this desire in the Chinese political and economic system to keep on building, to continue the infrastructure forever, infrastructure fever, excuse me, says Li Shuo, a senior global policy advisor for Greenpeace in Beijing. Despite the news, analysts say they're still optimistic China will reach its climate targets. The world's biggest polluter has pledged to reduce its energy intensity, measured by comparing total energy consumed to GDP, and its carbon intensity, the carbon dioxide produced per dollar of GDP, by 2025. Chinese President Xi Jinping said in April the country will also reduce coal use beginning in 2026. Forecast clearing. China is already out in front on key green technologies like electric vehicles and accounted for about 50% of the world's growth in renewable energy capacity in 2020. And its growth in carbon dioxide emissions slowed in the second quarter of 2021. I think it's clear that there's already a shift from the runaway expansion of all kinds of industry and construction we've seen for the past year and a bit, says Lori Millie-Virta, an analyst who worked on the coal-fired power plant report to trying to at least moderate the pace. Under the heading World, White House memo, no good choices. Biden faces the fallout from his disorderly retreat by Brian Bennett. There's a photograph here of President Biden. He's behind the podium where the seal of the United States, the President of the United States, is shown. Two microphones are in front of his face, and he's actually leaning towards the microphones. He has a large memo notebook in his hand, but his two hands are clasped on top of the book, and he's leaning his chin on his hands. The caption reads, Biden takes questions from the press August 26, after 13 U.S. service members were killed in a Kabul airport bombing. It was the first time Joe Biden had witnessed dead Americans returning home from a foreign battlefield as president and commander-in-chief. The bodies of 11 Marines, a Navy medic, and an Army staff sergeant arrived on U.S. soil Sunday, August 29. All killed in a suicide bombing at the Kabul airport August 26, amid America's chaotic exit from Afghanistan after 20 years of war. For 35 minutes, as the flag-draped cases were carried down the ramp of an Air Force C-17 cargo plane at Dover Air Force Base, in silence except for the hum of aircraft engines and muted troop commands, Biden stood in front of the cold reality of his decisions. A series of fateful choices over the past 6 months drew a tragic line to that moment. It was Biden who in April settled on an August 31 date for withdrawing U.S. forces from Afghanistan. It was Biden who chose a minimum number of U.S. troops to secure the exit. And it was Biden, updated in intelligence briefings and meetings over the summer, who oversaw his administration's abandonment of a key air base, the delay in evacuating U.S. citizens and allies, and a belated scramble to provide more troops to get everyone out safely. Hard decisions are history's acid test for presidents. It is easy to forget amid the posturing and politics, but the architecture of American power means there are some calls that only the president can make. And when it came to Afghanistan, Biden was determined to make them. He had watched the war's launch as the Senate's top foreign policy overseer nearly 20 years ago, then fought and lost an effort to end it as vice president. Since announcing the exit, he's never publicly wavered on that call. For his political allies and his opponents alike, it was his experience and certainty that made the Taliban's lightning takeover of Afghanistan and the ensuing brutal scenes of panicked flight by American and Afghan civilians so shocking. How could Biden fail to forestall the humanitarian disaster headed his way? More tough decisions are on the way now that the last U.S. plane has lifted off from the Kabul airstrip. The August 26 bombing at Kabul's airport's Abbey Gate raises the specter of a continuing terrorist threat in Afghanistan. Biden now presides over the manhunt for the Islamic State Khorasan, ISIS-K operatives behind the attack. And August 29, a U.S. drone strike targeting ISIS-K operatives reportedly killed 10 members of an Afghan family, including 7 children. Between 100 and 200 Americans and thousands of U.S. allies in Afghanistan are now reliant on the Taliban for a way out. While economic collapse threatens a worsening humanitarian crisis, many of those who've escaped face a global purgatory at temporary sites as Biden's administration struggles to vet and resettle tens of thousands of refugees. August 31, a day after the last U.S. soldier left Kabul, Biden said at the White House that he took responsibility for the decision to end the war. As Congress prepares to investigate the withdrawal, he will be held accountable for the calamitous way it unfolded as well. In the weeks after he took office, Biden faced a deadline to deliver on his campaign promise to bring the majority of U.S. troops home from Afghanistan. Donald Trump had struck a deal with the Taliban in February 2020 that promised a May 1, 2021 departure for U.S. combat troops and the release of thousands of Taliban prisoners in an exchange for an end to attacks on U.S. forces. Taliban negotiators were holding firm to the terms of Trump's deal, and during four National Security Council meetings early this year, Biden sat at the end of the long wood table in the Situation Room in the basement of the West Wing and asked for his options. There was dissent among his top advisers at one Principals Committee meeting that included Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley. Biden's top national security officials debated whether to rip up Trump's deal, to ask the Taliban to extend the May 1 deadline, or to keep troops on the ground indefinitely. Milley, who served three tours in Afghanistan, said he thought it was important to keep the existing presence there to prevent the country from falling apart, according to two senior administration officials. In the end, Biden winnowed the choices before him to either leaving on a fixed deadline or having a permanent troop presence in Afghanistan, which would mean returning to an active shooting war with the Taliban. After a final NSC meeting in mid-April, he officially made the decision to get the troops out. "It's time to end the forever war," Biden told the country April 14, standing in the same room in the White House where George W. Bush had announced the first attacks on the Taliban in October 2001. Biden's decision to leave quickly, with a minimal number of troops to preside over the exit, meant abandoning Bagram Air Base, a massive, well-defended facility 40 miles outside Kabul. With orders from the president to take Trump's troop level of 2,500 down to zero by August 31 and defend the U.S. embassy in the process, the Pentagon decided not to ask for the 2,000 additional troops it would have needed to keep Bagram running. "We had to collapse one or the other," Milley told reporters August 18, and a decision was made. A dark meme shared among U.S. intelligence officers as chaos spread in late August attributed a fake, snarky quote of Sun Tzu's Art of War: "Always abandon your most strategic airbase right before an evacuation." But it was how the Pentagon left Bagram that may have had the most damaging knock-on effect. Afghan troops woke up at the base July 2 to find the Americans gone, having left in the middle of the night without notifying anyone. Later that day, Biden tried to make things appear under control, telling reporters the U.S. departure was on track, exactly where we expected to be. But the military's abrupt and secretive departure from Bagram emboldened the Taliban and demoralized the Afghan troops fighting them, administration officials now admit. Within weeks, Afghan forces collapsed in major provincial capitals as the Taliban took back the country with little resistance. As the situation worsened, Biden belatedly changed course. Wednesday, August 11, a previously scheduled evening National Security Council meeting in the Situation Room on a different topic was derailed by what to do next in Afghanistan. Biden tasked the Pentagon to deploy more troops to the region and shore up the Kabul airport, from which he ordered the military to begin evacuating civilians. Biden's team warned the Taliban not to enter Kabul, but when Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled August 15, one day after assuring Secretary of State Antony Blinken he would hold the line, the Afghan security forces melted away and the Taliban took the city. By August 26, when a suicide bomber affiliated with ISIS-K donned a vest packed with explosives, and made his way to the Kabul airport. It was U.S. Marines and other U.S. service members who were manning the airport's frontline checkpoints, checking papers and conducting pat-downs for thousands trying to flee the Taliban takeover. In the wake of the attack and U.S. departure, Biden is still scrambling to evacuate the remaining Americans and Afghans who helped the U.S. during the past two decades. American military and intelligence officials outside Afghanistan are ramping up the effort to track terror groups inside the country, relying more on unmanned drone flights and information sharing with local allies to head off deadly plots that might target the U.S. Tens of thousands of refugees are stuck in camps from Doha, Qatar, to Fort Lee, Virginia, awaiting screening and resettlement. Even as the consequences of his decisions continue to unfold, history's already preparing to pass judgment. Republicans and Democrats on Capitol Hill are readying investigations into Biden's chaotic evacuation and gauging what political impact the deadly withdrawal will have on passing his transformative economic legislation. In capitals around the world, allies and adversaries are weighing what the shambolic U.S. departure from Afghanistan means for its power and influence. And Biden's own allies inside the White House and the Democratic Party are trying to assess the effects of the bloody August unraveling on his and their political future. Brian Bennett wrote the article with reporting by W.J. Hennigan. Literally turning the page, I am now looking at a photograph of a woman dressed in black with dark hair, shoulder length or longer, glasses on her head. She's standing beneath a very leafy but dark tree. She's also standing in a graveyard, and there are flowers in front of her, perhaps a plant on the ground, or maybe a bouquet of flowers. They look something like hydrangeas. Again, under the heading World, withdrawal, grieving one of the last U.S. soldiers killed in Afghanistan. This is the article to which I referred when I read the cover items. By W.J. Hennigan, San Antonio. Photographs by Peter Van Ochtmeyle for Time. The caption on this photo, which is two pages in color, although it's mostly very dark tones with a light blue sky, just barely penetrating the background of these very heavily leafed dark trees. 18 months after her son Hagwar was killed in Afghanistan, Sylvia Gutierrez reflects on his life and the end of the war. Turning now to the text, Sergeant First Class Javier Hagwar Gutierrez is buried in grave 104B of Section 14A at the Fort Sam Houston National Cemetery in San Antonio. The white marble headstone is shaded by a willowy oak and adorned with a miniature American flag and a fistful of red, white, and blue flowers. Another photograph here on this inner page. It covers 1.5 pages, and it's the doorway into a room that is highlighted with a bright red sofa on beige carpeting. There are throw blankets on the back of the sofa with a big 7 in the middle. Throw pillows in red, matching the sofa itself. 4 U.S. flags in their triangular shape atop the back of the sofa. There are white Venetian blinds higher up on the wall, and between the two blinds, the set of blinds, hangs a small, well, maybe it's not so small, I can't judge the size of this window situation, but it's red with a white insert. U.S. Army, it says, Javier Gutierrez, and there's a gold star on the white center with a gold star hanging beneath it, which looks to me like it might be one of those stained glass dream catchers. There are photos on the wall. Photos, apparently they're all of the same young man, Sergeant First Class Javier Jaguar Gutierrez. He's there in his uniform against a backdrop of flags and medals. And there's a framed U.S. flag, again in the tri-corner fold. The sunroom in the Gutierrez family's two-story brick home in San Antonio is decorated with remembrances of their fallen son. Returning to the text, August 27, Sylvia and Javier Gutierrez make the 29-mile trip to their son's grave site, just as they've done dozens of times since his death 18 months earlier. Time and again, they've come here carrying photographs and fresh bouquets and family gossip. They've also carried a burden inside, one no parent should have to bear. Their son was one of the last two American soldiers to die fighting in Afghanistan. Jaguar, 28, and an Army Ranger were shot and killed February 8, 2020. An Afghan service member turned his gun on them just 3 weeks before the U.S. signed a landmark peace deal with the Taliban. Despite the tragedy, the Gutierrez family managed to take a measure of solace in the fact Jaguar would be one of the last soldiers to die in the nation's longest war. The pain, they thought, would stop with them. But now they were passing on their burden. The day before their visit to the cemetery, a suicide bomber killed more than 170 Afghans and 13 U.S. service members at the Kabul airport. The grief Sylvia and Javier had endured over the past year and a half would now be felt by yet another group of shattered U.S. families, a new set of bereaved parents. Becoming a Gold Star family is an honor nobody seeks. No one can fathom the heartache endured by the mothers, fathers, wives, husbands, daughters, and sons of the fallen. There is an emptiness, Sylvia says. I feel like I'll never be whole again. This war, although it's coming to an end, will not end for me. The Taliban's sudden takeover of Afghanistan is a bitter reality for all Americans after a generation of war. But the jarring spectacle hit especially hard for veterans, active duty service, and the families of the 2,461 service members who've died in Afghanistan since 2001. Many questioned whether their sacrifices mattered. The Department of Veterans Affairs and military vet groups reported an uptick in calls to suicide hotlines as the catastrophic collapse of the Afghan government and rushed U.S. exit from the country unfolded on national television. My son and those that have spilled blood there or come back with missing limbs, they gave everything, says Javier, a former Marine. We're better than this. Sylvia and Javier listened to satellite radio during the ride to the cemetery. Images of the ignominious withdrawal flipped through their minds like a slide deck. The frantic airlift in Kabul, the desperate pleas of Afghans turned away at the airport gates, the bloody wreckage of a terror attack, the youthful faces of 11 men and 2 women who gave their lives to save complete strangers. They find Jaguar's grave along the cemetery's main road, amid a sea of other headstones inscribed with the names of people who fought in conflicts many decades ago. Sylvia and Javier sit on the manicured grass and speak softly to their firstborn son. Through tears, they describe the latest news the best they can. They reveal their shared feelings of helplessness. They tell him they love him and miss him. They make sure to remind him they are proud of his sacrifice, and then they head home. The middle name, Jaguar, came from his father, a Desert Storm veteran with shoulder-length black hair and a passion for heavy metal. Javier had visions of his baby boy one day standing before sold-out arenas with a Stratocaster guitar. Jaguar did not share his father's affinity for music, but he did love the name. He was Haguar from the start, Sylvia says. It was clear early on Haguar would follow his dad into military service. As a child, he watched old war movies, read military history books, and played video games like Call of Duty. He arranged toy soldiers around the rim of the bathtub and put on goggles, Sylvia recalls. I'd see him in there splashing like he was caught in a battle. This is how his family remembers Haguar: childlike, eccentric, adventurous. His sisters, Hanaya, 35, and Jordan, 28, remember their brother as a goofball, a guy who'd lick the remote control to keep them from changing the channel, a guy who once borrowed Hanaya's three-day-old Mazda Tribute to go pick up a Gatorade, only to return 30 minutes later drenched in sweat, having locked the keys in the car, which had also acquired a bunch of scratches. He had a contagious giggle, which could be triggered by almost anything. He played football, but he was not crazy about it. He did not care much for school either, maintaining a C average, which his father believes was likely because of untreated dyslexia and attention deficit disorder. Haguar, now that's spelled J-A-G-U-A-R, and maybe this family pronounces it Jaguar. And I apologize if I'm not pronouncing it correctly. Haguar's intelligence emerged, however, when he applied himself in the armed forces. He enlisted in 2009 at age 17, during his senior year of high school. Much to his father's chagrin, he chose the army, like his great-grandfather Thomas Ortiz, who served during World War II, over Javier's beloved Marine Corps. Haguar found immediate success as an infantryman. After completing basic training at Fort Benning, Georgia, he qualified for airborne school and got assigned to the storied 82nd Airborne Division in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. There he met Gabby, a daughter of Honduran immigrants who worked as a waitress at an IHOP restaurant near base that he frequented. The two began dating and married a month later. After a 9-month deployment to Iraq in 2010, he attended Special Forces Assessment and Selection in 2013 at Fort Bragg. He graduated 2 years later from the Q course, an excruciating training program that soldiers must pass to earn a Green Beret. When he passed, Haguar did not want his mother to go to the ceremony or post photos to her Facebook feed. His reservedness about his accomplishments made Sylvia feel guilty about talking so openly about him, even after his death. But she knows what she'll reply when she sees him in the afterlife. "I'm going to tell him that he should have done something else with his career," she says, "something people were less interested in knowing about." Haguar was assigned to 3rd Battalion, 7th Special Forces Group at Eglin Air Force Base, Florida, as a Special Forces Communications Sergeant. He and Gabby settled into a 3-bedroom, ranch-style home near base in the Florida Panhandle. They had 4 children, Gabriel, Eden, Helen, and Emmy, who now range in age from 4 to 8. He was a doting and loving father who read the Lord of the Rings books aloud to his children each night before they went to sleep. He loved the fantasy trilogy so much he'd watch the movies before every deployment. 7th Group is a highly trained unit that primarily conducts missions in Latin America. Its members speak fluent Spanish and work with local forces in remote jungles to combat foreign threats. Yet each of the past 3 administrations has also deployed the elite group around the world, using it as an alternative to sending thousands of conventional military forces and risking the political blowback that comes with it. In January, Haguar's 12-man team of Green Berets, named Operational Detachment Alpha, ODA 7313, embarked on a new set of orders: deploy to Afghanistan's Nangarhar province under a so-called train, advise, and assist mission, accompanying Afghan forces who were supposedly in the lead. But that was just semantics. The assist part was difficult to distinguish from a traditional American combat mission. it certainly have the same risks and the same consequences. Stopping here now to share more photography from this article. It occupies two half pages. Six photos. Mementos belonging to the family of Army Sergeant First Class Javier Jaguar Gutierrez, killed February 8, 2020, in an insider attack by an Afghan soldier a few weeks before the peace deal was signed between the U.S. and the Taliban. Okay, there's a lock of dark hair and some kind of a sealed envelope, transparent. The Holy Bible, it says Operation Worship Holy Bible. It's a paperback, dog-eared on the corners, and it looks like it's in kind of a camouflage paperback cover. A file, autopsy report, Jaguar. A bunch of photos, half a dozen or so, of Jaguar as a young kid with a Snoopy shirt on, and looks like a couple of more photos behind it, tucked in back of him as an older youth or young adult. Some kind of a dragon figurine. And some notes. One says at the end, "Thank you, Dad. P.S. got the stamps." Okay, returning to the text. The call that forever changed the Gutierrez family's lives came on a Saturday evening a little after 5:45 p.m. Sylvia and Javier were getting dressed to make a 6 p.m. Valentine's Day party at their Baptist church. As usual, Javier was lagging, hastily buttoning his black shirt and tucking it into black slacks when Sylvia's phone lit up with a call from Gabby. When she picked up, she could not understand her daughter-in-law. The words seemed jumbled. She punched the speaker button. "Me mataron mi esposo, me mataron mi esposo. Me mataron mi esposo," she repeated. "They killed my husband." From across the room, Javier heard what Gabby was saying, but it did not make sense. What was she talking about? "My first thought was, no, 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 that could not be true," Sylvia says. Then I remembered that I had seen a report on social media earlier in the day of an insider attack. I put it out of my head because it wasn't like Jaguar was the only soldier in Afghanistan. About 2 hours later, an army officer appeared in their doorway. He told Sylvia and Javier that Jaguar's Green Beret team had been ambushed by one of the Afghan troops they were helping. The military's investigation into the attack, more than 100 pages of which was reviewed by Time, is heavily redacted. The unit was assigned to help a meeting between Afghan officers to help clear the way for the peace accord that would be signed 3 weeks later. ODA 7313 and Afghan forces returned from the meeting to a small military base and requested a U.S. helicopter evacuation at 3:20 p.m. local time. The request was pushed back three times by higher command. The investigation does not explain why. Around 6 p.m., the mixed group of U.S. and Afghan soldiers were unwinding and shedding their bulletproof vests after sunset prayers. It was then Sergeant Muhammad Jawid, 23, fired two or three bursts from his machine gun into the resting troops, many with their backs turned. Jaguar was shot 9 times. The fatal bullet tore through the back of his helmet and lodged in his brain, killing him instantly, according to the report. Army Ranger Sergeant First Class Antonio Rodriguez, 28, was also killed, and 7 other U.S. soldiers, 2 Afghan soldiers, and an Afghan interpreter were wounded. Within 40 seconds, Jawid sprayed 75 to 150 bullets into the group before he was shot and killed by security forces. Investigators determine Jawid was likely self-radicalized and influenced by Taliban ideology. The report does not connect his attack with another that occurred at the same base less than an hour later, in which U.S. soldiers reported being shot at least 2 positions, including a guard tower when helicopters arrived. Javier found the report suspicious, believing the events must have been linked. He thought the U.S. government did not want to publicly acknowledge the attack was coordinated by the Taliban for fear of losing support for the impending peace deal. but he admits he'll never know for sure. 2 days after Haguar's death, his remains arrived on a C-17 cargo jet at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. President Donald Trump and Vice President Mike Pence had shown up unannounced to stand with the Gutierrez family in the winter darkness. As a light mist began to fall, the plane's cargo hold yawned open. 6 soldiers with white gloves emerged, carrying Haguar's flag-draped transfer case off the back of the plane. Overcome with grief, Gabby sprinted down the tarmac toward her husband's casket. She was wailing, repeating his name, as she threw herself onto the C-17's ramp. 2 soldiers helped comfort her and carry her away. "The only thing that I was thinking was I need to see my husband," Gabby says. "I didn't care about anything else or who else was there." When their son died, it felt to Sylvia and Javier as though they'd been dropped into an alien landscape. Javier compared the feeling to a vacation years ago when he and Sylvia had a stopover in Turkey. Airport officials were trying to give them directions, but they did not know the language. "I did not have the words to help myself," he says. "The family did not know what they should do, whom they should call, or what they needed to plan for. Grief gripped them in strange places, the aisle of a grocery store, mid-sentence in a book. Finding moments of levity was impossible. They felt like the simple act of laughter was a betrayal." Abridging this slightly, here's the end. Haguar's death has become a defining element of Sylvia and Javier's identity. They've transformed the sunroom at the front of their 2-story brick home in San Antonio into a museum for their dead son. "We just try to remember the sacrifice he made," Javier explains. "You look at what's happening now in Afghanistan and ask yourself, was this all worth it?" He has to believe it was. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.